I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book is called The Higher the Monkey Climbs. It's a novel, and its author Bruce Geddes joins me now. In it, Richard is confronted with the theory that his father Gord's death 25 years ago may not have been accidental. Cousin Tony tells Richard that Gord's former boss and union official Al Forzanti may have been involved. I'll get Mr. Geddes to tell us more, as much as he'd like, about his book, the characters, and the past that comes back whenever it does, the mysteries of our relationships, and what we do or don't do to understand ourselves. Bruce Geddes is a writer whose fiction has appeared in the New Quarterly, Great Lakes Review, and the Hart House Review. He has written two books for Lonely Planet and has worked as a producer for the CBC. He has an MA in Latin American Literature and is a graduate of the Humber School for Writers. This book is published by Now or Never Publishing. The Twitter handle is @OlBrucey. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto, Bruce Geddes. Mr. Geddes, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. As I say in the introduction, it's best that the author tells us as much as I'd like about the book so that, you know, I don't end up spoiling anything, because I'm in the midst of it right now and I'm enjoying it a great deal. Richard, this character, who is he?
Well, he's a Toronto immigration lawyer in a job that he's not really fond of or particularly good at. He's from a town called Wanstead, a city called Wanstead, I guess, in southwest Ontario, where his father was a quite powerful labor lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically where he's starting out.
Yeah, and so the father died, I guess, 25 years ago. Gord, when we first meet Richard, 25 years after his father's death, what does he, I guess, know of how his father died?
Richard believes it was an accident involving a city bus that plowed through a red light and hit his father's car. He doesn't think there's anything wrong with that. That's just, you know, one of those tragic things that happened. But he doesn't see any foul play involved.
Yeah, and so his cousin Tony, I guess, what part does he play in his life at that point?
Well, Tony believes that there's some foul play involved, and that Richard's father, whose name is Gord, was actually, the death was orchestrated by Richard's boss, Alistair Forzante, who was the head of the union for which Gord worked. And Tony has a bit of a conspiracy theory going on that suggests that Gord was planning to take over the union, and Alistair Forzante found out about that and so had Gord killed. And he's gotten to the point of obsession with this where he's consuming him and he's looking for evidence. And he brings Richard down to Wanstead on false pretenses, hoping to involve him in the case.
And are Richard and Tony, are they close?
Well, they were. At one point in high school, they were, but they drifted apart, as, you know, friends and cousins tend to do. Tony stayed in Wanstead, and where his teenage girlfriend was pregnant and had a baby, and so he was kind of forced into the real world a lot sooner than a lot of people are. And whereas Richard went on to school and university and law school and moved away to Toronto.
No,
lost touch over the years, kind of.
Right. And so coming back together again, I guess I want to know what sort of state of mind is Tony in?
Well, I think that, I mean, Tony, it's a little ambiguous. I mean, in some ways, Tony hasn't changed at all.
Uh-huh.
He's still adhering to the values that he held on to, that sort of Gord tried to instill in him back in the early 80s. You know, he's got I think anyone would consider sort of old-fashioned notions of honor and manhood and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And he's sort of failed to evolve with the world, whereas Richard hasn't exactly thrived as the world has changed, but at least he's accepted the way the world has changed and has moved on.
Yeah, so when the world does move on from a lot of us, it can be difficult because, you know, a lot of sort of the traits that we have or the habits that we have or the beliefs that we have, we think, you know, is character. Did you want to say something about that in terms of, in the course of writing this book, about how For some people, it's easy to move on, and for some people, it's not.
Yeah, I mean, on a small scale, it's. I think everybody has a difficult time at some point adjusting to change. You know, small things like the way your bill, your electric bill is computed, like that can be infuriating.
Yeah.
But on a larger scale, just about how the values of the world are changing, and without necessarily consulting you. You know, you don't feel like you're always a part of the change, and so when the world goes on without you, and you don't, you might not disagree, you might not agree with the way things are going. It leaves, I believe, a trail of resentment and frustration. In Tony's case, for example, you know, he's a blue collar worker who's working for a lot less money than he used to make, and in part because a lot of those manufacturing jobs have disappeared.
Right.
And so he's forced to work for lower wages than he once did. So there's things like that, which, you know, has a tangible monetary value, but also, you know, gives him a lot less power than he once had.
Yeah.
And I think collectively that guys like Tony have a lot less power now than they once had.
Yeah, and so adjusting to change, I mean, that's something that we all have to contend with, and some people do it better than others. I guess it also says something about the times we live in, doesn't it? I mean, you talked about manufacturing. I mean, that's a sector that was, in some parts of the world that was considered that you would work in that in those sorts of jobs for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you know, you're taught to say sort of diversify and I guess look elsewhere sometimes, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's not only you work there for the rest of your life, you would work there for the rest of your life and make enough money to support a family and put your kids through school, like through post-secondary education. And you know, there's a real sense of mobility that I don't think exists anymore for blue-collar workers or people in those lower-end manufacturing jobs.
Yeah, and that can consume a lot of people. I mean, I guess in a way... Tony is, I mean...
Yeah, if you're caught in the wrong time, you know, when you're... Tony's in his mid-40s amidst all these changes. If he was in his mid-20s, he could, you know, learn how to program a computer or whatever, but for Tony, it's a little too late.
Yeah. So the other thing as I'm reading the book is the sense, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, in terms of a theme in the book, and that is we don't know everything about our past, and... at the same time, it shapes everything about ourselves, whether we know it or not. And so, when we do find out about our past, and I mean, it can jolt us sometimes, you know, right? When certain things come up, or you know, you find something out about something that happened in the past about other that affects other people, but certainly affects you. Or that other people are responsible for, and that affects you. In terms of how Richard reacts to some of the things that come back, are those things the way that he reacts to certain things? I mean, how did you come to some of those that you write about in the book?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a part where Richard's talking about when there's a heavy rainstorm. And the townhouse where he lives is prone to leaks in his basement. And he's always a little afraid after the storm passes to go down to the basement because he knows there could be a lot of damage and he doesn't want to have to deal with it.
Uh-huh.
And that's a bit of a metaphor for how he feels about, in this case, about uncovering what really might have happened with his father. Because he's, you know, it's one thing to find out if your father was murdered or not, but then there's a whole other bunch of information there that you might not want to know about who he really was, how he operated, and, you know, and whatnot. And I mean, it's not a, you know, you don't have to have a father who was murdered to go through that stage where, you know, when you reach your parents' age where you can remember what they were like.
Yeah.
And you can remember back to specific things and how they reacted or what, how, you know, what they said. And you didn't understand at the time, but now you do because you have that perspective. And so there's that intersection of memory and understanding that I think is really interesting, and that's where Richard is remembering certain things, and he has a certain understanding because he's that much older. But does he want to deal it? Does he want to go down that road? Does he want to go into that basement? You know.
Yeah. And so, for a lot of people, it's easy just to, you know, not go down there. You know, not go down to the basement, not deal with you know, everything that you have to deal with, emotional and otherwise.
Exactly.
So Richard is forced to confront these things, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then he decides he has to eventually. Not really giving anything away, I don't think. But there's, you know, things that happen with Tony especially that make him realize that he's, whether he likes it or not, he's going to have to go down and go about that basement.
Yeah. Now, the book is written in the first person, so I'm assuming that a lot of people talking to you about this book are going to ask how much of yourself is in this character.
Yeah, I guess that's a natural reaction. I chose the first person mostly because it's what I'm used to writing in. I mean, I write a lot in journals a lot,
mm-hmm.
and so it just seemed the most natural voice for me. And also, I like the idea, you know, that these inner conflicts are more easily explored in the first person than in the third person, I think. There's a few things in there that are, you know, anecdotes that are taken from experience. The scene where there's a crow they're sitting on the church steps and there's a crow that doesn't move.
Uh-huh.
That basic thing happened and remains fixed in my memory, even though it happened about 30 years ago. A few other things, you know. I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, which is basically the model for Wanstead.
Yeah.
So that city is sort of based on Wanstead. Based on Windsor.
Yeah. I guess the other question that people are asking is what the title means, The Higher the Monkey Climbs.
Well, it comes from a proverb. The higher the monkey climbs, the more you see a dash.
Mm.
So it's basically kind of warning people that, you know, the more prominent you become, the more people will see your faults. At least that's the way I interpret it. I think another interpretation is the higher the monkey climbs, the more they tend to screw up. And I think that's kind of a warning for anybody in any profession that, you know, as you climb up that ladder, you've got to be careful because more people are watching you and scrutinizing you. And things you might not want exposed are going to get exposed.
So then what do you make of people that don't strive, that don't, say, have ambition and are willing to, say, just wallow in you know, I guess, wherever they are and not try to move on?
I mean, I'm fine with that. That's their choice. But you do give up. Certain, I mean, there's no free lunch, right?
Yeah.
You choose not to do anything and you miss out on whatever you were trying to do, and you choose to do... to go for that ambition, and then you risk a whole other set of risks that are going to be presented to you.
Yeah. Well, back to the way you wrote this and the voice you use. As the writer, when you're working on this novel, and it's written in the first person as it is, when you're, I guess you're at your desk, I'm assuming, embodying the character itself. I mean, do you spend so much time with the character that now that you've already published it, that it's hard to get away from him, say?
Well, this was written over a long period, and the bulk of it was written several years ago. So I've moved on to other books and uh-huh. projects, so I haven't had that problem. But I found that as I was writing it, you know, the kind of cool thing is you're writing and you live longer and longer with a character, it becomes more and more narrow. Like there are fewer and fewer options that a character has because you form them in such a way that you know, they can only behave certain ways.
Uh-huh.
You know, it presented with at the beginning of the book, they might be presented with a choice and there are 30 different ways to go. But after working with a character for long enough, you know, that whittles down to maybe one, two, or three different choices that make sense, you know, based on the character. So in that sense, well, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but the time you spend is worthwhile that way. because it makes a more defined character.
And so in your own life, after writing this book and spending time with these characters and the things that they go through, are you left with any, say, wisdom about or understanding about your own life, say?
Maybe a little bit more. I mean, I'm certainly going through that process right now where, you know, I'm 49 and or about to turn 49, and I have quite vivid memories of my own father and our neighbors at that age. And so when I think about the things that they did or said, I'm understanding it with that new perspective. There's that framework was definitely established for me through writing the book.
Boy, that hits you. I mean, I'm 36, and in the last couple of years, I started, you know, sitting down and thinking about, you know, at my age, whatever age that would be, what my parents were doing, and it's almost, you know, it takes your breath away sometimes to
yep.
just look back at the people around you and overwhelming sometimes when you try to look ahead.
Yeah, I had a recent experience with a friend of mine who I was in grade two with, and our grade two teacher was quite friendly with another teacher, a male teacher in the school, and it suddenly struck us for the first time ever that they were having an affair, and all of our memories now, you know, make us realize that what we were witnessing was an affair between two adults, but back then, no idea.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The memories haven't really changed, it's just the interpretation of them has, so.
Yeah. For some people, though, it can change their memories of what they think of certain people and situations when they recall their past, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. I think that, I mean, and that's the case with these teachers, too, is that we saw them as teachers having a kind of a flirty time with each other, but didn't have any sense that there was anything sexual going on. But now that we know how adults are, it was clear that there was something going on. So. Yeah.
Now you went to Humber,
yeah,
at the School of Writing there. How long does one spend there usually? Is it a couple of years of the program?
Well, the correspondence program lasts. I mean, it varies. I think you get about a year to get through the allotted number of pages they give you.
I see. And so you were mentored in particular by Miriam Taves and Paul Querington.
Yep.
What is that like in terms of working with people? That in some cases you might have read before you got to know them, right?
Yeah. It's good because you can ask, you know, you can get into the sort of the sausage maker's factory of writing. You can ask pointed questions about their work and why they made certain decisions here or there, why they chose to tell a joke in this place or why not, you know?
Yeah.
Which is great. It's really interesting to get into that sort of nuts and bolts of how things are created and how they were thinking at the time.
Yeah, and a lot of the things that mentors, I guess, teach you, some of it you use, obviously, and some of it you take with you, you know, are quite life-affecting and affect your writing. When you have now written a book yourself, and I'm sure people ask you for advice and ask you for wisdom themselves. I mean, a lot of the things that you tell them, I mean, are they from mentors that you've had as well?
I think yes. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there are certain, it's like in any course, you know, there are certain nuggets that stay with you forever. I remember Paul Quinton talking about the rule of three, that a scene with three people is always more interesting than a scene with two. But it's also a lot harder to write. So there's stuff like that I believe to this day. And then there's, you know, there's other stuff that you just kind of discover because what they help you to do is help you think like a writer. So as you're reading someone else's book, well after the course is done, something might trigger you in a paragraph that says, hey, that's kind of a neat way to do something. And that's because you've been taught a little bit more how to think like a writer as opposed to just, you know, getting like concrete lessons that you apply, you know, as an engineer would apply principles to building a bridge. It's a little more subtle, I think.
I guess that's one thing to think of, to think like a writer. But I'm curious to know, in terms of the habits of you as a writer, how much of those do you emulate from others in terms of, say, the time of day that you write, where you write, or how you write, or what you write on, even.
Yeah, I don't know really. I don't think that I've ever really looked at what the working habits of other people. I mean, other than knowing that you have to put a lot of time into it, that first drafts are usually terrible, and that you know you're more of your time is going to be spent on rewriting than on writing itself, and that sort of stuff, which is, you know, the wisdom of the ages for, you know, all the how to write a book. Books that are out there.
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, writing is rewriting. Because it is work, what parts of it are unenjoyable for you?
What parts are unenjoyable?
Yeah, I mean,
getting rejected is really unenjoyable for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the actual, I guess it's more fun to be writing the first draft than it is to be writing the 100th, that's for sure. But it's not unfun as long as you realize that you're making it better.
Yeah. And you've written nonfiction before. In terms of writing fiction, do you find that your brain works a little differently?
Yes, for sure. I think that my nonfiction is being helped more by the fiction. It makes me feel like I've got more tools in my box writing fiction. The nonfiction I write is it's pretty boring commercial stuff. If anything, it's the fiction that helps the nonfiction.
Yeah. And because I talk to writers all the time, and some people talk about the time of day that they write. Have you got a routine, say, or a regimen?
It's not too rigid, but I generally try and start by mid-morning. But I don't allow myself to, I don't worry about going to bed at a specific time. And if things are going well, I'll happily stay up until 2 or 3 and then adjust my day the next day accordingly.
Are you working on another book now?
Yeah, I've got one that's finished, and it's just with my agent, and I'm waiting to see what happens with that. And then I've got another one that I'm quite early on in.
And as you're talking about this current book, and you have to revisit these characters and some of the themes that you've written about. And as you mentioned a moment ago, it's been a while since you finished this. Do you look back at it with many happy memories?
Yeah, in general. I mean, now that it's out there, I certainly feel better about it than I did when it wasn't.
Yeah. Is that a sense of relief, say?
Yeah, definite sense of relief. Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's weird, like, that you can go from having nothing out there to having just one book out there, and nothing's really changed in your life or at all, except that now you have something to show people, which feels to me to be pretty huge, yeah. Career-wise.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on this. I'm enjoying the book, as I told you earlier. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much, Joseph.
The book is called The Higher the Monkey Climbs. Its publisher is Now or Never. Bruce Geddes joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.